This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
To the next stage of activism and tapped into something that had already been building for a long time.
She just tapped into anti-war sentiment that had already existed in this country. Her action down there just resonated with people. It hit a nerve in a very positive way and helped to catapult many more people into action. But this has been building for months now. Several months ago, for instance, in Congress, even, of all places, there was the development of something called the Out of Iraq Caucus, with more than 60 members of Congress basically saying it's time to end the war in Iraq. This is a tremendous development. Recently, over the last several months, the public opinion polls have shown increasing numbers of people from every walk of life, from every corner of the country, being critical of this war and wanting the war to end.
Kagan says the march and rally will move as close to the White House on the 24th as possible. You're listening to Pacifica Headline News with Leanne Caldwell. I'm Verna Avery Brown.
And you are tuned to listener-supported, commercial-free community radio WBAI at 99.5 FM. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille.
Everybody, this is Armand DeMille with you, with The Positive Mind, WBAI, 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, guests, things to think about. Between the recent tragedy, upon tragedy, the one that just happened today in Iraq, with the people dying from the panic in Iraq, and then the disasters in New Orleans and the tsunami and all the other stuff that's been going on in this world, it's amazing to watch people bounce back. Now, I've seen it my whole life. I come from the Lower East Side of Manhattan. It's remarkable how few people had the resiliency to come back. So there's comeback meaning to overcome some of these things that happened to us. So we decided to have today an interview with a very important person who's written a book, Dr. Al Siebert, S-I-E-B-E-R-T, who's working with the survivors of 9/11. We wanted to do this program nearer 9/11, but it turns out that next week our programming is preempted by the National Board doing a presentation of confirmation hearings and things like that. So I wanted to bring on Al Siebert. Al, are you with us today?
Yes. Hello,
Armand. Oh, good. You're right there. Hi there.
Yes.
Let's just jump right into this, because I want to talk about resiliency. I look at people and I find them amazingly amazing. The human spirit is so remarkable. But what does it mean to be resilient?
The key thing is to be able to bounce back from extreme adversity, to rebuild a life for yourself. In today's world, it also means that you're able to hold up under constant pressure and deal with nonstop change.
I would imagine there are some people, like myself, who are very resilient. And then I know there are other people who have been pampered their whole lives who are not very resilient. Do you think that division exists, that some people are going to make it and other people are not?
Yes, and it depends on the circumstance, on the nature of the challenge. So for some people, the physical adversity, some people are more well-equipped for that. Other people, it's psychological or emotional adversity. They might handle that better than someone who's physically going to be a better survivor in an outdoor crisis or disaster.
So Rambo might not make it if his wife left him.
Well, that's a very good example. Yes, yes, I agree with that. And what I also found, but even in outdoor adversity, I'm going to disagree with you slightly with that, because I even used that example. See, I'm an ex-paratrooper, and what we found in training camps and in the 3 years when I was in the service, the real combat survivors are more like the old Alan Alda playing Hawkeye in the MASH TV program. They're a little bit more like James Bond, perhaps. A key thing is sense of humor, relaxed attitude, sort of joking and playing with even a dangerous situation. In combat, the Rambo types are the first ones that get killed.
So
combat SEALs training and special forces training officers will tell you that.
Well, I guess that's what they're meant to be. You know, I mean, these are the soldiers who stand up to get shot down. You know, it's not the ones who are, the other ones become officers, and they kind of move around quite a bit. You have to have a lot of flexibility
sure.
to survive. Now, flexibility is a very key word. If you're a very rigid person, I imagine if you're a perfectionist or you're very rigid, you're less likely to bend with the trees.
Well, you know, it's a very close parallel to the physical body. I agree with you, and that has fascinated me. You know, I discovered when I first started interviewing really amazing survivors that they confused me at first, because they would be both sensitive and tough. They would be both deadly serious, but also playful like a child sometimes. They would act in ways that were both just altruistically unselfish, and yet at the other time they would take some action that was just purely selfish. I finally, it came to me that the real survivors, the ones with tremendous flexibility, have a long list of counterbalanced, or what we might call paradoxical, personality traits.
Oh, very interesting. I like
that. And this is what fits with the body, you see. So the flexible body, you have your flexor and extensor muscles working in easy, counterbalanced harmony. So you can move your hand, place your body, put your foot, whatever you want to do, exactly where you want, because you are at the choice point controlling the counterbalanced forces. And the same thing holds true in personality then. The people who are most resilient are most adaptable, most flexible. They can be at the choice point between being very optimistic, being pessimistic, being playful, being serious, and so forth. It goes on and on like that. It's fascinating for me.
I know people who are so optimistic that they don't have any resiliency. They don't know how to deal with any adversity. And I know people who are so pessimistic, it's a similar kind of thing.
You know, exactly.
They think that any disaster is proof that everything they've worried about is right. You know, they don't greet an illness as if it's something to be dealt with. Our guest today is Al Siebert, PhD, Dr. Al Siebert, who's written a book, a valuable book, because I've liked it. You know, I think, Al, we're going to have to talk to you about getting these for WBAI as well. The Resiliency Advantage, it's called. It's a book that gives you a guideline for dealing with how to become more resilient, because your belief, Al, I believe, is that people can change, even if they're not resilient, that they can train themselves to be?
Absolutely. You know, Armand, what it is, it works like this. You see, all of us as children, as human children, we're born with the natural motivation that comes right in our bodies to be curious, to explore. You know, kids, they ask questions. They are always getting into things. They're trying things out. They're like the young scientists, you know, exploring a marvelous world. And this is what leads to learning how to survive, learning how to cope, learning how to adapt. You keep learning lessons directly from your experiences with life. And the thing is that we can keep doing that all of our lives if it doesn't get squelched. And so remember old Abraham Maslow? He once said that no one achieves full self-actualization until at least the age of 60.
What do you mean by that? I mean, what did Maslow mean by nobody until they get to age 60?
Because we all are in the process, lifelong, decade after decade, of learning how to be ourselves better and better, learning how to interact with the world so that things work well for ourselves and other people, learning how to deal with adversities, learning to trust your intuition, learning how to avoid problems so you don't even have to be resilient in the first place. And it takes years. A person can take years to keep getting better and better at that.
What is a survivor personality?
I described that in my first book, published in 1996, about the people who had been through extreme adversity. They somehow managed to get themselves through. I was talking about ex-prisoners of war, survivors from the Holocaust. I heard Dr. Viktor Frankl speak when I was a senior in college. People like that who had become amazing human beings because of what they went through. So my description there was about people who somehow in some way got through a horrible experience, in part because of efforts that they made. And then secondly, after they were able to heal from what they went through, they found that their healing process, their struggle to recover and deal with the pain and what their memories of their experiences, had transformed them into a better and different human being than they were before. And that, so I've spent over 30 years interviewing folks like that. It's just fascinating.
Viktor Frankl is quite a life. I mean, quite living, having gone through and actually been in the concentration camps himself.
Yes, I had the privilege of driving him from my campus to the next campus. He was a very, very happy fellow, sparkly eyes, playful sense of humor, very conscious. And I was just amazed. I experienced cognitive dissonance because he was talking about horrible, horrible things I never knew about that the Nazis had done in the Holocaust. And yet here was a happy man talking about horrible experiences.
And his experiences in the middle of it. I remember one of the things that he wrote about was one day when laying there, and there was a man who was having a nightmare, and the man was about to wake up, and he thought about waking the man from the nightmare, realizing that there was nothing he could wake him to that would be better than the actual nightmare itself.
Isn't that amazing, that kind of attitude?
Yeah. Now here's Viktor Frankl, the search for meaning, or logotherapy, and the whole
yeah.
idea of searching for meaning. It must have been... I envy you that experience. That must have been real beautiful to be around that kind of a presence. What other people have you studied who have been real resilient? I mean, and you know, I'm talking about specific people.
And what I like to do is meet ordinary people, not people who have written books, but just people around who have dealt with amazing things.
Get it.
I talk about the... in my book, the woman who had been hired to work at a nuclear plant, she'd just gotten out of a very, very long, difficult marriage, had saved up a little bit of money, was now living in a little apartment she didn't like, had to leave a beautiful home that she loved, but she was moving her life in a new direction and felt very good about this great job she had with the nuclear plant. Was opened the morning paper, was ready to drink her coffee and read the paper, and here were the headlines. Nuclear plant shut down permanently. That's how she found out that she was going to be out of a job in just a short time. Her reaction was to, at first, be distressed by this, and her mother also had just been diagnosed with a serious illness at the same time. But she started looking at people and seeing she'd been through so much. There'd been some physical abuse in her marriage, and she'd been through so much that she was able to think, okay, I can handle this, I'll deal with this, and saw other people who had never been challenged in any kind of extreme way, just buckling under the devastation of losing their jobs, good people losing their jobs through no fault of their own. So she started going around helping people write their resumes. She wrote a column for the plant newspaper on how to save money, did a number of things that were so supportive and helpful and valuable for other people. And what was so delightful is that back at the company headquarters in human resources, they heard about her and were so impressed with her spontaneous stepping forward to do so much good work for people that they came to her and they said, okay, after your job has ended, we want you to come downtown and join us here in the HR department. So she ended her job at the plant on a Friday. Next Monday, she went down to company headquarters, had a better job, never lost one day's work, kept her fringe benefit package, everything. And she was just delighted. Her life has been that way. She gets hit with some bad news. She responds by turning it around, and she's just awesome. That's resiliency.
There recently have been some studies on children and the comforts that children have been getting by having cell phones available so that they speak to their mothers three times a day, having padding on the floors of their playground so that when they fall they don't scrape their knees, making sure that the children don't get hurt and that could be tracked at every moment. And a couple of psychologists have come out and said, you know, there's kind of a wimp factor being built in here, that the resiliency of these children is very limited because they don't have any of the natural tests of life. They're not being thrown out there in the world, and they're not surviving on their own. They're not figuring out how to watch out for themselves. They're being protected too much. What do you think, Al?
I would agree with that. I just did a television interview about the people in New Orleans and was pointing out that there's going to be a wide range of responses. I just know from my experience. And that is that you'll have some people who have had rough life experiences, especially outdoors. You have emergency workers. You're going to have ex-military from combat, old sailors, folks like this who have been through really rough outdoor experiences, mountain climbers maybe. And they're going to cope really well with the physical challenge and adversity. On the other end, you've got people who have never been through a rough experience in their lives, not of this magnitude at all. And here they're hit with the wind, with the rain, and the sound, and their whole world's being exploded before their eyes. And something like that to an untested nervous system, to someone whose mind and brain have never been exposed to that, they're going to end up with post-traumatic stress disorder.
So, and what is post-traumatic stress disorder specifically as it relates to the lack of resiliency? I mean, what is it? What we're basically saying is a stress disorder is the locking in of the muscles. You know, you have no way of getting outside of yourself, so you implode. Isn't that what it is?
Yes, it's a mixture of things. I know something about this from my work with Vietnam veterans and here with the VA hospital to some extent. So it's something that really appears to be a kind of combined neurological, chemical, muscular sort of thing. It's like a powerful imprinting of the nervous system that is mixed with shock, with terror, with horror, and that it's not just something that's a memory now. It's actually there's a neurological basis for this. And by the way, you know, this is not mental illness. This is a normal person's reaction to a shockingly distressing high emotional trigger sort of experience that they have, and it doesn't go away. We have three key signs for this, and that is that a mixture of insomnia, nightmares, flashbacks, the memory keeps intruding into the person's consciousness either day or night. Second is that there's a constant hypervigilance in the person, fearful that this could happen again. So even a sudden unexpected summer storm that suddenly blows up and rain starts coming down, the person will have a panic reaction of, oh, my God, it's happening again, even though everyone says, no, this is just a summer storm. And then third, there can be physical problems. Usually there's anxiety, there's stomach problems, high blood pressure, heart irregularities of some kind, asthma perhaps. She can get some physical symptoms, too.
I imagine what I see in most people with post-traumatic stress disorder is that they eventually crack under the strain of their own bodies being such nervous wrecks, and that what happens is when they crack, finally they get a chance to process the emotions that they didn't allow themselves to go through. And it sounds more and more that resiliency has to do with being able to go through emotional moves that maybe other people can't do, you know, like being able to feel sad, being able to deal with loss, being able to get angry. If you can't feel your emotions and that's been prohibited to you, it's very hard to get through things.
Yes, that's right. And so the some people will try to suppress their feelings, not want to even allow them up. That doesn't work very well. They may try to use alcohol or drugs. They may get prescription medications. None of that works because the PTSD does not go away with time or medications or avoidance at all. You're quite right. We found consistently the only way for the person to get out of it is to make the decision. They will make the heroic inner journey to go back through the feelings. And here's what we're after, Armand, and that is that we're not trying to make the memory go away. What we're doing by writing in a journal, talking with people, going through it, telling the story over and over, over a period of time, is that you gain control over your memory and your story rather than letting it continue to control you.
Well, let's go over that a little more, because I remember the 9/11, people who were in the middle of 9/11 and how they had to deal with it.
Yes.
And as we come up near that, you're going to be, I know that you're a very active part of this. I remember as I was doing my counseling with people who were in the middle of it, they had this need to tell the story again and again and again. And I frequently wondered what my ideal response would be. And then I realized my ideal response was to let them tell the story. I mean, it was the ideal was not to interrupt, not to explain, not to do anything except to really let them tell the story. What happens in a human mind when it relieves itself by repeating a story of a tragedy, by talking about it? How does that work?
My read on this is that it's acquiring verbal control over the memory. And also there's something else that happens, and that is that by choosing to repeat the story, to talk about it and so forth, even though it's painful, it's distressing, that's why I call it a heroic journey, what happens is by choosing to be able to tell it, you also acquire the ability to choose not to tell it. And so we're not making it go away. We're just giving the person control over it, and now they can begin to socialize more. And what we did with Vietnam veterans, and I mentioned this a year ago when I was with the World Trade Center survivors, is learn three responses. One is that when someone asks, they hear that you went through this and you were there, you can say to them, I was there. You know, I don't care to talk about it right now. Second, you can give them a short one- or two-sentence statement. I was there. It was a horrible experience. I would not want anyone to ever have to live through that. How about you? Have you ever been through a really horrible experience? Turn it right back to them. And keep the time when you are willing to go into depth, when you've got someone who's a very, very good listener who won't intrude with their feelings and their political opinions about how it was mishandled. So, you know, that happens. So, don't you have people who would tell you that, Armand, so many
times? What do you mean?
You'll have, let's say, someone that you're seeing and working with, and they say, I'm willing to talk with a few people, but as soon as I start talking, they start immediately giving me their opinion.
Sure.
And they stop listening.
Sure. It's almost like they think that they're going to be helping you in some kind of way by interrupting you, by not letting you go through it.
I know.
Or maybe they're just uncomfortable with the feelings of the intensity of that. I mean, if you were on the inside of anybody's mind in New Orleans recently, you would find it shocking. If you were in Iraq last night, or actually any time in Iraq over the last couple of years, you would find it shocking to know that it's this level of panic and fear and terror and pain.
Yes, it's awful to. But and the thing is, though, that the best we can do as healers, helpers, I think, is just to remain present while people go through their experience and be available if they request some assistance or some help. I myself don't volunteer help.
If people, what do you mean you don't volunteer help?
If someone's going through something, I'll just say, how are you doing? How do you think things are going to work out for yourself? I'm just going to stay right in their experience, maybe ask a question. if they seem to be at a place where they might respond to that. If they're feeling the deep grief or whatever, they just need someone to sit with them, someone to put an arm around them, let them go through what they're going through.
Mm. It's the time to cry on somebody's lap if you have somebody who you really love who's very
yes.
close to you. And it's a time when you, as the mate of the person who may have gone through this,
yes.
to learn to keep quiet.
Yes.
No, it's not the time to talk them out of it. But I think we do that because we're uncomfortable with the feelings ourselves. Now, specifically when there's a tragedy or there's an immediate thing that happens, some people want to go and help everybody. Does that, you know, we know that in the case of the death of somebody close to you, let's say your mother dies, there are some people who go around and they take care of the whole family, and they suffer some of the biggest consequences because they never went through their own feelings. And there are people in the middle of the tragedies who are great heroes. They're helping everybody. But they're very likely to suffer for this later down the line, aren't they?
That can happen, yes. Yes, so there's a couple of different things going on here. I'm not sure exactly which direction you want to go.
Well, the thing I'm curious about is watch out for the caretakers. Be grateful for the caretakers.
Yes.
But at some point, give them a chance to break down. And if they hold up,
oh, yes.
if they hold up too strongly, you know, maybe offer them a safe place to talk about everything they truly felt as opposed to just congratulating them for being so strong and so agile and so... I remember one young man, he was from a very strong family, and by strong I mean a family who was, you know, always felt very... they were not very emotional. And his mother died, and it was at his mother's funeral that his uncle walked over to him and said to him, "You know, you've got to be strong for the family." And he looked at his uncle and he said, "You be strong for the family. My mother just died. I want to cry."
Good for him.
And good for him is exactly right. He went through it.
Well, so let me just do a slight add-on. I do workshops called Caregiver Resiliency. And what I find is that the kind of people that you're talking about are there, they're helping and they're going around and so forth. They're exposing themselves to other people's pain and distress. And they can get something called bystander PTSD. They can actually develop their own, a certain form of a PTSD from allowing the full impact of all this tragedy and distress and pain and loss to penetrate into their feelings. So in my workshops, if I'm coaching people in advance, like I worked with the group of government, there's a government emergency crisis response team that went in to take over handling of the materials and infrastructure supporting people working at Ground Zero. And one of the things that I cover with caregivers like this is to learn how to be present with compassionate empathy without allowing yourself to have too much empathy, to not allow their experience to become your experience, but to be present with the person with compassion, but you keep some boundaries so that you don't allow their experience to become your experience. So that's a key thing I try to teach in working with any people who are caregivers.
Al, if you could stick with us today, I'd like to go just a little further into it because I want to go into the steps that people could do to actually get more resilient. What we do here on the program, since I know you're talking from Oregon and we're doing this by telephone, we usually take a short break just about now, and then I play a little music. And today I'm choosing a piece of music by Erik Satie because I could feel this riding on top of the giant sob that's out there in the world right now. And so just in recognition for the depth of feelings of what people have, I'd like to be able to provide them with a soft moment. And then when we get back, we'll be talking more with Dr. Al Siebert. Al, I know you expected to be with me a half hour. Could you stick around a little bit longer?
Oh, yes, definitely.
All right. So when we over the next few minutes, just to let you know, you'll be an open microphone. So if somebody walks in and you happen to say to them, you know, blah, 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 it's going to be heard on the air. Okay, so stick with us, Al. We'll be right back in a few minutes. This is Armand DeMille.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
I love Al Lewis live, Saturdays at noon. Oh, yeah.
I'm Karen Lewis. I love my co-producer, Grandpa Al Lewis, together with
engineer Eliza Butler and you, the listeners.
We talk about politics, community, and social justice, things you can get passionate about. Al Lewis Live.
Saturdays, noon to 1:30 p.m.
Get passionate about something. Oh, yeah.
Eric Satie, J'aime nos pieds. Every workshop I've ever done, I've found there has to be a somber moment, a sober moment for people to come down off their intellectual pursuits, their thinking, their trying to figure things out, to a time when they could get into their heart in a shared way. Strangely enough, you're still with me, I'm sure, Alan, right?
Yes.
Yeah, strangely enough, it's whenever I put Satie on, specifically, it does the work immediately. Now, aren't you going to be doing something here at St. Paddy's Cathedral in New York?
I was checking the address here. I'm going to be at St. Vincent's World Trade Center Healing Services, 170 Broadway, 12th floor. That'll be on the evening of the 9th.
Evening of the 9th, working with the people who are...
Yes, my topic is Become a Resilient Survivor.
And that's it. And that's exactly the idea, specifically for people who have been through 9/11?
Yes. People who are in the towers.
People who are in the towers.
Right. There's a special network of people who are in the towers. They rather got ignored right after 9/11. They weren't talked with very much. They weren't given a lot of support, and there was no way to really organize them. They were scattered all over the place, but they've gradually been coming together and creating their own support network.
And what do you think is what has been happening? I mean, what did you hear in the middle of it? The terror, what did they need to be able to go through? I mean,
well, each person has their own way of dealing with it. Some people it's faster recovery, others it's more difficult. There one woman who coped really well had actually been in the building when that truck blew up in the basement. And so when she heard the warning, she took it seriously, whereas other people heard the warning in the building, and they This is typical, just like in New Orleans, many people heard the warning and they just shrugged it off. Oh, they can't really be serious.
Hmm.
So, but the people going through this, people have their own. They need to take their own time and do their recovery in their own way.
Well, if you go through the initial phase,
yes,
of any trauma, and let's say you are hit with a major unexpected difficulty, whatever it is. Now, what are the key ones that they talk about in life besides environmental disasters? There are loss of your home. What are the primary disasters that people usually have to face? How would you categorize them? Would you say divorce or death of a loved one?
You're tending to get into the areas where many people, if they feel motivated to do so, will see a psychotherapist or a counselor. See, most of my work and my book is written to focus for people in the workplace who are finding that they're having to deal with constant change, constant pressure. They get hit with job loss and they have to struggle to find employment again. In the midst of that, they hear that their father has Alzheimer's or something like this. So I've really written my book for people who are finding that they need good resiliency skills to deal with ordinary life. We're not talking to people about what to do in case, you know, in advance, in case you happen to be hit with a tornado or an earthquake or a forest fire or a hurricane.
All right. Well, then let's just try to see one of the ways that you would approach people. You know, you talk about writing a list. What is difficult for me list?
Yes.
What is that about?
That is partly to overcome the good child handicap. You're saying about how some children are raised and they're too protected and so forth. The handicap to being resilient is having been raised to never complain, never be unhappy, always smile, don't be selfish, don't talk back, don't get angry, things like this. Don't be prideful, don't be stuck up. And when I'm trying to work with people on how to cope with some of these challenges, I find I keep bumping into the good child handicap. And so one of my first ways of getting people to move out of that a little bit is to just say, look, we've got all this research, you know, listen to what the experts say, and that is, it's okay and it's necessary sometimes to sit down and make a list of all the things that are upsetting you, getting to you, bothering you, that you're feeling upset and irritated about.
Do you have specific? I see you have some specific words. What pressures am I feeling is a key sentence.
Yes.
Okay. Number two is, how is my work and my life different than it was a year ago?
Yes.
Now that's an incredible question because that's what people are feeling. You know, I mean, people always feel themselves trying to get more and more secure over time. And when they turn the corner, when a tragedy hits, and they see themselves in worse shape than they were a year ago, that is too much for many people to handle. And so in addition to that question, your next question is, what is difficult for me now, and what difficulties am I expecting? And now comes the big question, what actually feels distressing to me?
Yes.
How do people get to identify that? You know, how do people get underneath I lost my job. How do they get underneath that to what really is distressing them?
If they're out of work, I'll tell you that lack of income and lack of having a health care plan is right in their face, and that's what they have to deal with. And so what I'm coaching people on what to do then is how to go ahead and write about that. There's, you know, everything in the book. You know, my book is summarizing the new emerging new field of resiliency psychology.
Yes.
So we've got good documentation. James Pennebaker has even written a book about this, on the power of writing about your feelings about what's going on. Then I take that another step and say, okay, all right, now you've done your list. Now pick one thing on the list that you're going to go to work on in order to minimize its impact. So what can you do to change it or stop reacting this way or to make it go away? Do something. So we slowly show people how one thing at a time to minimize distressing experiences, but also it's essential
Well, give me an example.
And do the positive experiences.
Give me an example, Al, I'm sorry, of one thing that a person might find on a list that they might change, because I'm a little confused as to what the list is.
Sure. So they might put down, I really get irritated with all this negative talk that's going on whenever I'm in the lunchroom. So it really bothers me. People just gripe and complain and talk all the time. So in negative ways. So one thing might we'd say, okay, what are some possibilities? You might come in and say, let me tell you a funny story I heard. Anyone else hear a funny story? You can choose, instead of going to the lunchroom, go for a walk during lunchtime. Say I'm on a fitness program and I'm going to walk during the lunch hour. A third way, if you're not going to get out of there and if you're not going to do something different, is stop reacting to it and just say, okay, they get to do that. I get to sit and listen to my iPod music player.
Well, and also get to listen differently.
Yes.
You know, in other words, if you're listening and you're saying, so this is the way they're handling their wound, and I'll watch them handle their wound this way, I will choose not to be a part of that. I'm not going to join them. I'm not going to be in the cackle with them. You know?
I wouldn't assume it's a wound. I'm not going to talk about it in that way.
Well, if everybody's sharing, let's say the loss of a job, let's say a company cutback, sure.
Oh, see, but you asked me what appears on people's lists.
Yes.
And I'm saying that what appears on the list is this negative kind of chit-chat, the gossipy, backbiting stuff that goes on so many times in the lunchroom, in the workplace, or in a person's friendship circle or something. So and the thing is that, you see, most people with positive attitudes have a negative attitude about negative attitudes, and it drives them crazy.
Wait. Do that. That's very cute. Most people with positive attitudes have a negative attitude about negative attitudes?
Yes, and then when someone starts talking in negative ways, it bums them out.
Oh, I see.
So my approach is fine. Anyone who talks in ways that constantly upsets you, take a look at yourself. Why are you vulnerable to that? What is it that's getting to you? What is triggering this response in you?
So maybe you're afraid of your own negativity, and that's part of what all your positivity is about, so therefore you can't handle anybody who's being really negative because you're afraid they're going to bring you down.
Yes.
You feel vulnerable. You feel that your stance is not solid.
Yes, so, there's partly that, but there's also a little bit of self-esteem thing in here. You see, it's the good child again, saying, I not being raised to be prideful. And you run across people who are the opposite of what a good human being should be, and you cluck your tongue, oh, look at them. Look at they're doing it wrong. You're supposed to be smiling and happy and positive. They're always negative all the time. What you're doing is the same thing they're doing. You're building yourself up by tearing them down.
When you're hit with a major unexpected difficulty, Al Siebert says, and this is in his book, again, I'll mention the book, The Resiliency Advantage. Dr. Al Siebert, it's about the survivor personality and developing a survivor personality, meaning if you don't have one, and Al teaches you tricks that you could use to develop your mind to be better at surviving. That's kind of an interesting thing because, you know, I think, Al, people who consider, and I've just looked through your book and thought about this, there are a lot of people who consider leaving their marriages. And sometimes they say, I'll never make it out there without this marriage. I feel so dependent, you know, on this marriage and relationship, so they stay in really horrible situations. And I was going through the book with that in mind, saying to myself, how do you develop the mind that gives you the strength? Well, psychotherapy is terrific, but I think a $6 book is even better.
Well, you know, as long as the book recommends... My book isn't $6.
No, I know.
But my book recommends that if you're a little bit on, you don't have that much self-confidence to start with, you've got to align yourself with a support group, with one person at least, and maybe a couple more, who have been through this and can be a resource, can keep coaching you, encouraging you, saying, oh, yes, and they'll tell you how rough it was on them. But they said, hang in there because I made it through. And you put your finger on something that I just saw again reported in a psychology journal, and that is that when men are in an unhappy marriage, that they say is unhappy, they'll stay there because it turns out that men, even in a married men, even if they're in an unhappy relationship, are emotionally, physically, psychologically better off than unmarried men. On the other hand, if a married woman is in a bad relationship, bad marriage, she is worse off than unmarried women.
Worse off meaning that the general quality of life...
Psychologically, physically, ill more often, emotionally more distressed, has more physical problems, the various things that they tend to look at in terms of their full psychological and physical well-being.
So there's something about a man being in a relationship that in some way gives him a certain level of security that he's generally better off, healthier, happier, more secure, more solid, physically better when he's in a marriage, even if it's an unhappy marriage, because he could somehow pull it together. But for a woman to be in an unhappy marriage, the statistics kind of say that if she's in an unhappy marriage, she will tend to get more sick, be unhappier than she would be being out there on her own.
That's right.
And one of the ways that she could develop this skill is to, if she thinks she can't get it through, I think the resiliency advantage might be a strong consideration. Let's talk about people after the major tragedy.
Sure.
What are the important questions that they could, what could they write down to help them get themselves through? Okay, so like, what does this question mean? What is the important question I should be asking?
And that's where I start. You've asked what I call the master question. So, and what you're getting at is not so much the fact, you know, we're not looking for the magic question. But my point is that a key indicator of resiliency is that the person is always asking questions. And so they might ask, okay, now what are the key questions I need to be asking right now? So what do I need to do to take care of myself? What do I think is the best plan of action for me at this time? What would be plan A and plan B? What do I hope optimally will be the best outcome here for me? What would be some unusual things that might happen that I can be pleasantly surprised about? What can I do to take care of myself during this time? What would be good for me to do? What would be fun? What would let me laugh? What would let me forget this for a little while? And it's different for each person. You know, someone might like to watch some comic, humorous videotapes. Someone else, it's time with friends. With others, it's out running or jogging or something. Some people like to go out and dine or eat. Every person is different.
Well, here are some of the other things you say. I think these are, I like these questions. One of the questions is, what is happening, what is not happening?
Yes.
Okay, so let's take a situation like you've just lost your home to an avalanche.
Yes.
Right? Now you're out of your home and you don't have your home. What is happening, what is not happening? What do you imagine? How would a person answer that?
So you're looking, what you're trying to do with that question, here's what the purpose is, Armand. The question is trying to absorb into your mind an accurate hologram, an accurate internal picture of exactly what's happening all around you, both what is happening and what is not happening, to not act on beliefs or fears or assumptions about what's happening, but to just absorb pure, straight information about what's occurring. You see, the people who are the most resilient have the best inner mental maps of the world that they live in, and they get that with quick questioning.
So what is not happening is a very important question.
Yes.
What is not happening? I am not dying. You know, I still have my... What is not happening is that I've lost my family. What is not happening is that there are a number of things that a person could ask. Another question you ask that I think is a wonderful consideration, how serious is this? Now, you know, you might very often, when you see something tragic happening to you, you might say to yourself, you might say to everybody around you, this is a tragedy, I'll never get through it. But when you ask yourself the question, how serious is this, which includes maybe your physical health is still there, you know, that maybe, you know, you've still got many things left. That is a very important question. On a scale of 1 to 20, how serious is this? What is the worst thing that could happen to me? How serious really is this?
Yes, yes. And you'll find a tremendous range, you probably in the stories, eventually in the months and years ahead that come out of this Hurricane Katrina, tragedy, is that you find some people, their home, they lost their homes, all their possessions, and this is a person who had a more detached, more philosophical view of life, and they can feel for a short while the loss of specific family mementos, some pictures, personal papers and things like that. But they look at the house and they go, you know, I'm still alive. The house is gone. It's just stuff. It's just boards and bricks and wires and glass and so forth. And I'll get another place that I'll enjoy. Now, other people, the loss is just ripping them apart because they are emotionally so connected with every bit of the plate from grandma's house and the memento that they still have from their eighth grade graduation. It goes on and on. Some people are surrounded. They're so emotionally embedded with so many things happening, and this loss is just totally ripping them apart. So you get a whole range of different responses. So that's what I'm saying. I'm not going to assume how anyone is going to react. I'm going to be there and present and observing. And for people who are receptive to a little bit of resiliency coaching or something, I might mention something.
The Resiliency Advantage by Al Siebert, PhD, is the book. And Al, there's another very important statement in your book that I liked a lot. When you're in the middle of a disaster or a tragedy, I'm a to-do kind of guy. I'm a guy, okay, what's next to do? I do this, I do that. What's the next thing we've got to do? Okay, we've got to get that. We have to get food. We have to get shelter. We have to get... There is a time to do nothing. And it's very hard for people to imagine there is nothing to do. And I think the mind almost can't handle in the middle of trauma that there's at some point there's nothing more to do.
Well, and this is part of the test of real resiliency, and that is the ability to stop and do the opposite of what has been typical of you to be doing. And so you can talk about specific behaviors. I'm going to constantly reach for that underlying principle. Can you and do you sometimes pause? Do you do the opposite of what you typically do?
Time to stop. Time to stop looking. Time to start searching. Time to stop beating myself over the head for how I caused it. Now, there's another, you don't approach that factor in your book, but self-blame and self-criticism in almost any trauma becomes such a debilitating.
Yeah, that can happen. It can happen in marriages when a child is killed.
Sure.
Oftentimes, very few marriages last after a child has been killed because people get into that. You know, if only you hadn't done that, if only I had done this. And those folks need really, really good professional counseling.
Well, the same thing happens even now in the midst of this kind of a tragedy. Like in New Orleans, there are people who are saying, well, we should have moved out of the city. We should have known. We should have. There are people who are going to be criticizing themselves, and that's going to be their primary focus, and that's a surefire path to depression. You know, it's one of the sure ways of getting depressed is to be critical of yourself. There may be something that you could have done. But the self-blame becomes something that could actually be have greater consequences.
Yes, and that's the key thing. So people who tend to be victims tend to dwell on the pain in the past and blame other people for their pain, whereas the resilient people focus on the future. Okay, it happened. It's over with. Maybe things could have been different. They weren't different. This did happen. Now, what do I need to do to make things better for myself and my family and my friends and people important to me? What can I do to make that happen?
We've been speaking with Dr. Al Siebert. Al, thank you very much for being with us today. So once again, you're going to be doing the workshop here in New York City. Can people get to you through your website?
Yes, the website is resiliencycenter.com. So sure, they can send questions, inquiries, whatever. They can take the quiz. I've got a nice quiz they can take at the website.
Good. ResiliencyFactor.com.
Resiliency Center.
ResiliencyCenter.com.
Yes.
Thank you very much for being with us, Al.
Very good. I enjoyed it, Armand.
Sure. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. If you want a copy of today's program, you would call 212 757-4488. Hey, my friends, you know, next week, no programming at all. So we won't be with you. They're going to be covering the hearings and through Pacifica Radio, so don't think anything's wrong. We will be back with you shortly after that. But, of course, if you miss The Positive Mind, you just go to the website, thepositivemind.com, go down to where it says Archives, and pick a program to listen to. Because I'm sure you haven't heard every one, and we have many up there for you to hear. I will be back with you in a week. And between now and then, my friends, love to all of you.
After 4 years, the truth surrounding 9/11 still remains suppressed. That's why on Sunday, September 11th, New York 9/11 Truth invites you to a march and rally. It's time to end the media blackout. Starting at 1 p.m. at the New York Times Building, 229 West 43rd Street, we'll march to Fox, CNN, and NBC to a 4 p.m. rally at Dog Hammarskjöld Plaza at the United Nations. At 7 p.m., come to our second event, Creating a Culture of Truth, at St. Mark's Church, 10th Street and 2nd Avenue. For details, go to www.ny911truth.org or call 212-714-7147. That's ny911truth.org or call 212-714-7147. Silence equals consent equals complicity, so be there for 9/11 Truth.
Although you have made a pledge to WBAI before the last fund drive ended, the drive really doesn't end until you have paid your pledge. Please, if you have not yet honored your pledge, do so as quickly as you can. We need your support so that we can continue to bring you the valuable programming that we offer on a daily basis. So, once again, if you have not yet honored your pledge, please do so today. Thank you.
And you are tuned to listener-supported, commercial-free, community radio, WBAI, WBAI.org, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Please do honor your pledge to this commercial-free, listener-supported radio station. WBAI programs are now being archived, and this is what you need to do. If you're interested in that, go to archive.wbai.org. You can also find out about archiving through our website. That's wbai.org. www.wbai.org. My name is Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide. Thank you so much for tuning in and for staying with us. Coming up in a moment, about a minute, will be Perspective with Luis Reyes Rivera. Please stay tuned.
Que vontade de chorar, dói. Em pensar, ela não vem só dói. Mas pra mim tá tranquilo, eu vou zoar. O clima é de partida, vou dar sequência na vida. De bobeira que eu não estou.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.